Welcome, welcome, welcome inside Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Avi, the balance of power between three co-equal branches of government has been a defining feature of American democracy.
And Schoolhouse Rock,
yes. But some are now asking whether the balance is at risk. You heard at the top of the hour this week, the Trump administration allegedly ignored a federal court ruling when it deported more than 100 migrants to El Salvador, despite a judge's order temporarily blocking their removal. The administration's actions have raised alarm bells, in part because President Trump has called for the impeachment of the judge who issued that ruling. And this drew a response, a rare response, from Supreme Court Chief Justice, John Roberts. And so people are sounding the alarm. And because there is numerous court cases pending, other court orders out there, and it's sparking questions about whether the president has finally gone too far. So we're going to do what we do here at Studio 2. We have two legal scholars with differing viewpoints. They're going to help us walk through some of the major issues that what has happened over the past week has sort of teed up. And we want to hear from you, our listeners. The question of the day is, do you think we are headed toward a constitutional crisis? How much executive power is too much? And I'm going to throw this in there. Where is the line?
Oh, throwing in a third question.
Where is the line that you think should not be crossed by the president? You can call in and share your thoughts. The number is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, hello, YouTubers, tater tots, all of y'all, be sure to leave your question or comment in the chat.
We yesterday asked folks to nominate a show topic for our second anniversary.
Yes, we did.
And we put it out there. We said, what show would you like to see us do? We'll do it in early April. And the first submission that came in was this
Jinx, I'm knocking on wood.
Which we were already planning to do. So I apologize to that person. You were too good at the exercise. You get an A++++. So we are still taking submissions, by the way, for a show that we should do for our second anniversary. You can send those to studio2@whyy.org. But today we are talking about constitutional crisis, what it is, if we're there, if we're headed there. We're also going to talk about a trio of local news stories. And the first one is actually on this topic of immigration.
Yeah.
And this is an update from central Pennsylvania. We learned this week that six Bhutanese former refugees who are residents of the Harrisburg area were detained by ICE despite the fact that they have permanent legal status. And many in that community are asking, why were these six men detained? It's been noted that some had nonviolent criminal records. One of the men was convicted of assault in 2013, but has done his time and has been released. Again, six men with permanent legal status, former refugees from the nation of Bhutan. They've been detained. They were Pennsylvanians, and a lot of folks raising questions because they don't know why these men were picked up.
Yeah, and that area near Harrisburg has a very robust, refugee community there. And I think this story to me raises the question of where the line is again. You know, President Trump promised on the campaign trail that we would see the largest, most expansive mass deportation effort in history.
Mm-hmm.
But the thought was that it would be people who were undocumented and had committed crimes. And these are individuals who had legal status and they went through the process, the proper channels. They were vetted and they got that legal status, which is so hard to get. And so it raises a lot of questions about why they were detained.
It sure does. And I think there might be a pattern emerging here between this case and the case we're going to talk about later, is that when we're seeing actions that feel like oversteps, they're directed at people that I think the administration believes will garner very little public sympathy. So the people defending those people will seem like they're defending people who, like in this case, have committed some crime.
Mm-hmm.
That's what seems to be materializing here. And that's a very unsympathetic position to take. Meanwhile, you're breaking legal norms while doing that. And I do think it feels to me targeted and strategic, but we shall see.
Yeah. Another thing that we'll be looking at is whether or not some of the row offices end up being consolidated into other areas. And this question is raised by the Pennsylvania Intergovernmental Cooperation Authority, or PICA.
Yeah, just stick with PICA.
PICA, yeah. It's the fiscal watchdog for Philadelphia, and they voted to recommend getting rid of the sheriff's office and the register of wills. The unanimous resolution calls for consolidating the functions of those independently elected offices, by the way, into appropriate city agencies to save taxpayer dollars. Why are you probably wondering, would this fiscal watchdog make this determination? Well,
okay, they said, why?
With regard to the sheriff's office, they said, look, there are numerous reports detailing financial mismanagement in that office, lack of internal controls, and problems with sheriff sales, right? As for the Register of Wills, that office has faced accusations of patronage hiring. Mm. And this vote from PICA is largely symbolic. They lack authority to abolish, you know, municipal offices independently, but they're putting this on the mayor's desk. They're putting this to city council. They're saying, look, save taxpayer dollars. Right now, we haven't heard from the mayor. We haven't really heard whether or not city council is going to make a determination on this. But the sheriff, Rochelle Bilow, vehemently disagrees with this recommendation.
No kidding.
Also rallying the troops, telling folks, you know, folks are coming for her. But this vote follows a similar recommendation from Watchdog Committee of 70.
Yeah.
So this isn't the first time.
So lots of people,
that people
are saying,
feel like these two offices need to go.
Get rid of the sheriff. Get rid of the Register of Wills. It is strange that we have a sheriff and they are elected.
Yes.
They don't have a lot of responsibilities.
Nope.
But hey, at the same time, these people were elected.
They were.
And often many times reelected. These are tend to be pretty low information votes. But, you know, I do think it's a question about democracy and the limits of representative democracy. Different cities have different elected offices. And here in Philadelphia, I think at least one of these, maybe both, date back to the colonial era.
Yeah, they do. And by the way, people have said that these colonial era row offices have outlived their usefulness and that eliminating them could save a lot of dough, right? But I will say in 2010... they did get rid of one row office. The 300-year-old clerk of quarter sessions court.
And I miss him every day.
That was abolished by a ballot referendum. So it's not unheard of.
Sure.
I know. I don't think anybody misses that.
Who's
court.
Clerking the quarter sessions, man?
I have no idea.
Okay. All of that talk of government has made me hungry, Cherry.
Did you hear my stomach growl? It was low.
We need more sensitive microphones for that. Okay. So we love this.
Mm-hmm.
The Inquirer did a roundup of the 20 best hoagie spots in our region, and they put them all on a map. They mapped them out.
I love it when they do stuff like that.
This is a great resource, by the way. A lovely job by the Inquirer. So 20 amazing hoagie shops throughout the region. No surprise, a plurality of them are in South Philadelphia. Six or seven, depending.
Your stomping ground.
Yeah, six or seven, depending on your definition of South Philly. And I will say, at least like four of them are very close to my house. Not to dox myself, but you know, so
you're going to be trying.
I'm living good. Well, yeah. I've already tried.
Okay,
trust me.
Okay, trust. I've been to none of them, but Avi has tried several. Okay.
Trust. I've been to all of them. So, anyways. We were browsing this wonderful resource, and it got us thinking before the show, if you or I had a hoagie named after us, what would be on that hoagie? What would be on the Cherry Gregg hoagie?
Well, Avi, I'm glad you asked. I would have a toasted seedless hoagie roll, light mayo, Waldorf chicken salad, you know, the kind with grapes and walnuts. I'd add Swiss cheese and bacon, baby. Why? Because I like salty sweet. There you go. That's the Cherry Gregg hoagie right there.
Waldorf
deliciousness.
Chicken salad.
Yeah. I love chicken salad. I eat it like almost every day. Really boring. What about you, Avi?
I'm going to let that one land. I think mine would be, I got to go vegetarian.
Okay.
A fried eggplant cutlet type thing.
Oh, that sounds good.
But no marinara sauce, okay? I'm not putting not like a eggplant parmesan. No marinara sauce because I feel like it
you
tastes good.
You just want
good.
Plain eggplant?
Let me finish.
Okay.
I feel like it tastes good, but it's very messy. So we're just doing eggplant, sharp provolone.
Oh, that's good.
Long hots, sauteed spinach, and then a little mayo and oil. Very clean, very simple, really vegetal, but also a little bit decadent.
That is. I like it. It's very good. Long hots. I love it.
Now, finally, we asked ourselves, if Studio 2 was a hoagie, what would that hoagie be? And what we did...
I've been looking at your paper over there trying to sneak a shot. Like, what's going on?
Okay.
I'm sneaking a peek.
So we're very democratic here at Studio 2. And so we constructed the Studio 2 hoagie by having everyone on the team submit a component. But no one else could know what anyone else was submitting. Mm-hmm. So this is like blind democracy here.
Okay.
All right. So it's on a seated hoagie roll.
We agreed to that right at the top. Go ahead. Right.
The Studio 2 hoagie starts with a seated hoagie roll. Then there is bacon submitted by Cherry Gregg. Why did you submit bacon?
Because I love bacon. Bacon's the best.
Fair enough. Then there is sharp provolone by visual producer Mike Schiffler.
Oh, I like that.
Bacon,
yeah.
Provolone.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have Hers barbecue potato chips submitted by producer Paige.
Okay, Paige. And add a little salt.
And they had to be Hers because Hers is local and Paige is a suck up. Then, then we have dill pickles submitted by producer Andreas Copes.
Okay.
So far, bacon, provolone, potato chips, and pickles. Then we have banana peppers submitted by producer Debbie Builder.
Okay. I know Debbie loves some banana peppers. Look, I see her nodding over there.
And then finally, we have cherry pepper hoagie spread by executive producer Kevin McCory.
That is a sandwich right there.
Is it though?
I mean,
is it really?
There's not enough protein on there for me.
So here's what I would say. A lot of good stuff on the Studio 2 hoagie, but very little of substance. And that's truly what makes it the Studio 2 hoagie.
Oh my god.
Badoom-tsh. You got to be self-aware, Cherry.
Yes.
Anyway, so that's the Studio 2 hoagie. Pick one up at your local hoagie shop today. Bacon, provolone, potato chips, pickles, banana peppers, and cherry pepper hoagie spread. A bizarre beast.
The perfect thing to eat as we talk about a potential constitutional crisis.
Do
you
think
we're headed towards one? Call us 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. There is a showdown between President Trump and a federal district judge around the deportation of more than 200 alleged Venezuelan gang members to an El Salvador prison. On Saturday night, a district judge ordered the government to halt the deportations and turn the planes around. So far, the administration has not complied.
The Trump administration has claimed presidential power on this issue, citing an obscure law, the Aliens Enemy Act of 1798. And there was a follow-up hearing this morning between Judge Boasberg and the Department of Justice. And in recent days, the president and his allies called for Judge Boasberg to be impeached, which prompted Chief Justice Roberts to issue a rare rebuke of Trump on Tuesday. But this case and other actions by the administration have led to fears that we are heading toward a constitutional crisis and questions to whether we are already there with a president testing the court's authority.
We have two great guests with us this hour to talk about the questions of presidential authority, if Trump is overreaching, and that big hypothetical hanging over everything. What happens if a president ignores a Supreme Court ruling? Craig Green is the Klein Professor of Law and Government at Temple and a former Justice Department lawyer. Craig, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you. Love the show.
Thank you so much, Craig. And with us by Zoom is John Yoo, Professor of Law at the University of California at Berkeley. He formerly served in the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Counsel under George W. Bush. John, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
And our question for you, our listener, this hour, do you think we are nearing a constitutional crisis? How much executive power is too much? Call 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org, or if you're on YouTube, drop a comment right there in the live chat.
And so I wanted to start this conversation with just setting the ground, right? Americans, we keep hearing this phrase, constitutional crisis, is thrown around a lot, especially now. But what does it actually mean? I want each of you to define it and then answer the question of whether you think we're in one right now or getting really close. And Craig, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I think the narrowest meaning for constitutional crisis is the one that Avi referred to. If the president doesn't follow the Supreme Court's ruling on any issue, then there's a question of whether there's rule of law at all. There's a question of who does the military support. The law and the Constitution is declared by the Supreme Court, or the man who's ostensibly the commander-in-chief, the president. That's the doomsday scenario. That's the worst case possible for a constitutional democracy. What we're seeing now is much more a broader challenge to the rule of law, and do courts play a role in deciding what governed citizens, non-citizens, govern the government? As long as that's down to district courts or courts of appeals, there's always some other venue, some other court that can weigh in, the Supreme Court. But when it gets to the top, there's nowhere else to go. And that's when really the wheels come off the wagon.
So just to clarify, violating a U.S. district court order, but if a president does that, that is not a constitutional crisis.
Not in the technical sense that I would want to use. It's not the same as disregarding a Supreme Court. I could disregard a district court order and they start stacking up contempt, fines, prison. I can appeal those things to the Court of Appeals if I think the district judge has done me wrong, and that can go all the way up. But once you get to the Supreme Court, there's nowhere else to go, and that's the real difference. So there's a threat to the rule of law. That's what people mean today by saying we're in a constitutional crisis, but lurking out there is this ultimate possibility that would be really a threat to everything about the American government. Let me just say one quick thing. A U.S. president has never actually disregarded a U.S. Supreme Court order. But that's something people talk about as a threat, as a possibility. They've been talking about for decades.
Yeah. And John, did you have anything to add to that or to clarify as far as what the definition of a constitutional crisis is and whether you think we've hit one or are getting close?
Well, first, thanks for having me on the show. You forgot to mention my most important qualification is I grew up in Philadelphia.
All right.
My mom is 87 years old, has been listening to WHYY for 50 years. So how could I turn down this invitation?
Hey, Mama, how
and
you doing?
And second, you know, I'm glad to be on a show where I was talking about definitions. You guys can't even define a hoagie. What was that monstrosity that you guys came up with? Potato chips on a hoagie?
Donut chips on a hoagie.
It's got to be wise, but barbecue potato chips. Come on. We'll get back to that later. But the reason I'm talking about definitions, seriously, is because there's no settled definition of what a constitutional crisis is. We throw the term around all the time. I wrote a piece over the weekend saying, well, let's talk about the moments we could hopefully all agree we have been in a constitutional crisis before. I don't think there are that many of them. It's not just when the branches are fighting between each other about the scope of their powers or fighting over a policy. We should recognize that the founders created our separation of powers intentionally so that our branches of government would fight. And they wanted them to fight all the time. You know, James Madison said, the idea of our Constitution is that ambition must be made to counteract ambition. So I don't think there's anything wrong with a president being elected who comes in, has a mandate, wants to push forward an agenda, and meets with resistance in the courts, and gets upset and fights with the courts. He should also be fighting with Congress. Actually, the founders thought Congress would be the main opponent to the president. But that's normal from a constitutional perspective. So compare this to other times we've had crises where presidents really did talk about the idea of defying the courts or attacking the courts in a serious way. You have Thomas Jefferson, whose party in Congress tried to impeach a Supreme Court justice because of disagreements over opinions, not because the justice had done anything personally wrong, engaged in, violated the good behavior standard. You have Abraham Lincoln at the start of the Civil War. I think this is the only example in our history where a president refused to obey any judicial order. President Lincoln refused to obey a writ of habeas corpus issued by Chief Justice Taney, the author of Dred Scott, ordering the release of a Confederate prisoner at the beginning of the Civil War caught in Maryland, and Lincoln ignored it. I think that's the only example that goes as far as a president defying order. You had President Roosevelt threatening to pack the court because he didn't like the New Deal decisions that he was getting out of the court. He lost on that. And I think the last major one was Richard Nixon, right? Obstructing justice, interfering with an investigation into the Watergate burglaries, resigned before he could be impeached. And when I think about, are we in a constitutional crisis now? I ask, are circumstances now anywhere remotely as close to those historical examples, which I hope most people would agree were constitutional crises? I don't think so. Not yet. Maybe if we got to a case like you're describing, where the Supreme Court of the United States mm-hmm. ordered the Trump administration to do something, and President Trump just said no, absolutely not. Maybe we'd be there.
So it sounds like it sounds like you mostly agree that the sort of the end point of this, where we get to a true constitutional crisis, is Supreme Court says something, administration says not going to do it. I mean, that's basically what we're both talking about here. Am I right, Craig? Am I right, John?
That would be my point of view. I mean, you can use words however you want to use them. But to me, that scenario that you mentioned is the worst. And that's the thing that I think people are talking about. And that's the thing I think people are afraid about. When they hear some of the things that are being said by this administration about the possibility of defying judicial orders. So you have the vice president saying judges aren't allowed to control the executive's legitimate power. That's a dangerous statement, because whatever you think the separation of powers is, ever since Marbury v. Madison in 1803, the courts are the ones who decide how far the president's power can go. You can have a disagreement about whether it should be big or it should be small, but you don't disagree about who decides it.
Right.
And this is that scenario I was trying to describe before. If you really take seriously, Supreme Court says, do it. Trump says, I won't. Supreme Court says, don't do it. Trump says, I will. Then you really face this question of, is there a rule of law at all? Now, let me just say Nixon, just for example. Nixon had these secret tapes. They incriminated him. The Supreme Court said, fork him over. And he did. And he left.
Right.
There was no question like, maybe I'll just put him under my mattress. You know what I mean? Maybe I won't do that. That's the kind of difference between a certain kind of constitutional challenge or separation of powers or fighting about how big the president's authority
is. Between getting to the brink and crossing it.
And crossing it.
So let me get this comment in from Jeff, who emails us. In my opinion, the line was crossed when the Trump administration defied a judge's order and did whatever it wanted mockingly. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court giving him total immunity created, enabled, and empowered someone like Trump. So, John Yoo, let's talk about how immunity factors into mm-hmm. all of this, because it does feel, from a layperson's perspective, almost circular and confusing. Well, if it's a constitutional crisis if he ignores the Supreme Court, but he's also immune any official acts, and it would seem like if he did that, it would be an official act. It's very confusing, to be honest. So give me your interpretation of how immunity factors into all of this.
I think immunity is a separate question than whether we're in a constitutional crisis, whether the president is defying judicial orders. If you think about it, immunity actually was granted by the Supreme Court itself.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It wasn't something that was seized by Donald Trump. In fact, Donald Trump wasn't even in office at the time of Trump versus United States. I assume that's the case the caller's
talking about.
To. Yeah. And the whole point of Trump versus United States was, can a future president use the Justice Department to criminally prosecute the past presidents for something they did in their in the scope of their official duties? And that's really not, I don't think, involved with the constitutional crisis. We can argue and talk about whether the Supreme Court should have granted that level of immunity. I think a lot of people were surprised that the court did, but I think that's something that comes well down the road after any kind of crisis is over. I mean, the real, in my mind, the real solution, if you did have a president who, refuse to obey the courts, it's not that the system is completely at a loss. Because there's an immunity can't be prosecuted in the future, that we shouldn't forget that there's an impeachment clause.
Yeah.
And that's the mechanism the founders really expected to be used if you had a president who refused to obey the law. Let's take a step back, by the way. The reason why presidents have to obey judicial decisions is because they have the constitutional responsibility to take care that the laws are faithfully executed.
Mm-hmm.
That includes most people think, judicial decisions. Although theoretically, if a judicial decision was wrong, the president doesn't have to follow it. And I would point actually to Abraham Lincoln's comments about Dred Scott. This was a real problem for Lincoln because his party, the Republican Party, his candidacy as president was built on the idea that Dred Scott was wrong, that slavery was unconstitutional, immoral, and illegal. And so Lincoln said, I will carry out the decision of the Supreme Court and Dred Scott in the case of Dred Scott himself. I will not apply it or follow it in any other cases.
Won't extrapolate from it at all.
So the Supreme Court's going to have to order me every single time to release a slave, to recapture a slave and give him back, but I'm not going to voluntarily do it. Yeah. That's the farthest any president ever went. But it's still, I think, a reflection that there are vast amounts of things presidents do that are not subject to the direct control of the courts, that presidents do have some freedom to interpret the Constitution. We are living during this period where we're used to the idea of the courts being supreme and interpreting all constitutional questions finally, but that's not true over our history.
Yeah. I want to sort of ask this question because President Donald Trump also threatened impeachment. He called for the impeachment of the judge who made the order temporarily blocking the deportation of those immigrants to El Salvador. And I want to talk about judicial independence and how threats of impeachment could have a chilling effect on judges even being able to do your job. I want you to give your thoughts on that, Craig. Could threats against judges, calls for their impeachment, I mean, we've seen judges' security be threatened by the MAGA followers, some of them. How does that impact judicial independence?
Yeah, and judicial independence is another of these terms that has a broad meaning and a narrow meaning. But impeachment is a third rail. It's something that really hasn't been done this kind of way since the very beginning that John was referring to. And our tradition is judicial independence. It depends on the idea you don't go and impeach judges you don't agree with, because then you'd be impeaching them all the time. I think that this is one of the really important things about John Roberts' comment yesterday that you referred to, mm-hmm. is you have the Chief Justice of the United States saying effectively, judges, I'm watching what's happening, you know, and these cases, I think a lot of cases are going to come up to the U.S. Supreme Court. If you count votes, John Roberts could easily be a swing justice. He could be the fifth justice. And, you know, if you... The immunity decision was the nicest thing John Roberts ever did for Donald Trump, and was thanked for him in public, said, thank you, I won't forget this, Trump said to John Roberts in public. But I think John Roberts' message is, don't push my vote too far. Don't expect too much fond treatment. And I think a lot of judges right now, on your question about independence, as long as the U.S. Supreme Court stands up for judicial independence, as long as the Supreme Court stands up for the enforceability of judicial orders, like the one your questioner mm-hmm. asked about, as long as the Supreme Court is there as a backstop, as a safety net, as a guardrail, that's one thing. If the Supreme Court is not willing to force the executive branch to follow judicial orders, it's another thing. And then it's really, I think, so I think judicial independence depends on support. And I think right now the biggest support for judicial independence, I mean, they filed impeachment proceedings. I think a Republican filed an impeachment motion in Congress like yesterday. You know, so there's no protection from the president calling them raving lunatic left-wing people. Mm-hmm. There's no support from Congress. You know, maybe they wouldn't be able to get 2/3 in the Senate. I mean, impeachment has been a failure before. We don't need to forget.
Sure.
But I think the real support for being able to do their job, being able to interpret the law, being able to follow their judgment, being able to be independent the way people want to take for granted, I think that really comes down to the Supreme Court. They're going to have to answer for this eventually. Mm-hmm. And are they going to side with these sorts of traditions and institutions or whatever at the risk that the president might tell them to walk off? You know, yeah. Or are they going to be more like Trump for the United States? This is when the president cites that immunity decision every brief he files. You know, are they going to be more sympathetic and unleash President Trump the way they unleashed candidate Trump in the election year?
By the way, I just want to read the comments that Chief Justice John Roberts made yesterday. He said, quote, for more than two centuries, it has been established that impeachment is not an appropriate response to disagreement concerning a judicial decision. The normal appellate review process exists for that purpose. So he's telling him, look, this is a procedure. And John, do you have any comments? Because judicial independence could be threatened by the executive making threats against the judiciary, do you think?
I couldn't imagine a better way for the Trump administration to sabotage its cases going up to the Supreme Court than to start talking about impeachment. or monkeying around with what's going on in the trial court with these deportations and playing games with what time did the plane take off? What time did the order get issued? What form was it taking? You know, I actually think, this is all counterproductive for the Trump administration. I think they're appealing more to their political base, perhaps, and their supporters, and worrying less about whether it's really going to have an effect on the courts. Because this happened in the first Trump term, too. There were these attacks on the courts. Trump ended up losing a number of significant cases towards the end of his term. I think that my sense of it anyway is that the more kind of political attacks are going to be on the institution of the courts, on judicial independence, the more that the judiciary is going to circle the wagons, as it were, and make it more likely that they're going to rule against the Trump administration. And this is not an area, I think, where the courts would overturn any precedents or really change the law in order to saddle the Trump administration with losses. Some of these questions that are being raised in these cases are really novel questions where the administration is taking unprecedented positions. And so the last thing that the administration should be doing is, making idle threats. Because
Do you think they're idle?
It's politically impossible to impeach any of these judges. Mm-hmm. There's just not enough votes in the Senate. Members of the House are introducing impeachment articles all the time. I think like under the Biden administration, I think Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she filed impeachment motions against Justice Thomas and Justice Alito too. Nothing's going to happen. The House, I just can't see any judge being removed in our time, as Chief Justice Roberts says, because of disagreements about the substance of their opinions. And I would agree with you. If that were to start happening, that would be a serious disruption of the constitutional norms we've had ever since Jefferson's failed effort to impeach Justice Chase.
Yeah.
Let me bring in a caller now, but as we get ready to come up to a break, I don't know if we'll have time to answer this caller's question, but at least get the question in before the break. This is Andrew on line two. Hey, Andrew, you're on Studio 2. I think you have a question for us. What's your question?
Hello, guys. My question is, I'm still a little confused. What's most relevant to me is, when the Supreme Court makes a decision, are they just deciding on something and hoping the president follows that, or do they have actually any authority to enforce that, if that makes sense?
Yeah, that's the big question.
That's the million-dollar question.
That's the million-dollar question right there.
So let's get into it a little bit before the break, because we have about 90 seconds. Craig Green, I guess this kind of comes, for me, in my head, it comes down to, who controls the security apparatus of the country, the military? If there is a true head-to-head conflict, enforcement kind of comes down to muscle, does it not?
Well, there's two. Yeah, absolutely. That's one half of it. But the better half is tradition. So the tradition is, every time a president's got a decision he didn't like, he's followed it. George W. Bush, contrary to some of John Yoo's arguments, was told to do certain things in Guantanamo with ISIS and alienating combatants, and he did them. I said already, Nixon was ordered to fork over the tapes, and he forked. Yeah. Joe Biden was told not to do the loan program. He tried to do something different, but he didn't say, I'm not going to follow your order. That's the tradition side of it, and that's the culture side of it, and that's really important. But yeah, the muscle side of it, that's the thing. Nobody wants to know who the military is going to follow. If a president overstays his term, that was one of the things people talked about.
Sure.
If the president just won't leave the White House, well, then the military will follow him, or they won't. They'll either follow him or they won't, and nobody wants to know the answer to that question. There are other countries.
You're saying it's not really a legal question. I mean, it's a question of...
The generals will follow somebody. They've sworn to uphold the Constitution, and they also follow the president, but what if they part ways? Nobody wants to know who the military, whose side the muscle's on. That's what I think.
So we're going to go to a break, and then John, I'll get your response to that same question, because I do think it's the question that so many of us
who are
not legal experts ultimately come to. And so we're talking today with John Yoo and Craig Green and you about whether or not we are approaching or in or headed to a constitutional crisis, and where the boundaries of executive power should lie. Give us a call, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. And hey, we'll be right back on Studio 2 from WHYY. And And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the Trump administration's alleged defiance of a court order around the deportation of Venezuelan migrants on Saturday. This is all raising questions about the power of the presidency, the ability of the courts to keep him in check, if we will face a constitutional crisis, and what could happen then.
We have two guests with us this hour. We have Craig Green, the Klein Professor of Law and Government at Temple, and a former Justice Department lawyer. John Yoo is a hoagie expert, also the professor of law at the University of California at Berkeley. He formerly served in the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Counsel under George W. Bush. And our question for you this hour, do you think we are nearing a constitutional crisis? How much executive power is too much? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. And John, just before that break, we heard from the caller, Andrew, who was confused about what happens if we come to a true impasse between the courts and the president. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I want to make clear my jurisdiction extends also to cheesesteaks, water ice, and soft pretzels, okay?
And Scrapple. We know Scrapple as well.
I'm not limited. And Scrapple, too. I'm not limited to hoagies.
Yes, of course.
So, you know, the caller actually asked one of the fundamental questions that we argue about in constitutional law. And this was something Alexander Hamilton said immediately in the Federalist Papers. He said, you know, in our society, the executive has the sword. The executive is the one who executes the law, and Congress has the purse. And he said, and he was trying to claim the courts were the weakest branch, he called them. He said, what do the courts have? They have neither sword or purse. All they have is the force of their reasoning. They have judgment. And so the courts have always, from the beginning, relied on the other branches to execute their judgments. They actually rely on we, the American people, to accept their reasons and voluntarily comply with their opinions. I mean, this is a remarkable system, and it's worked, you know, amazingly well for over more than two centuries. So, and that's something Lincoln realized too. I said, when he was talking about Dred Scott, he said, though, I will enforce most judicial orders. I will obey Supreme Court decisions, even when I disagree with them, except in this question of Dred Scott, where I'm going to make the court order me case by case to carry out its decision because I think the courts are wrong. So I don't think this is something new, that what we're talking about now is something that's built into the structure of our Constitution, the weakness of the courts. And maybe that makes the case for respecting judicial independence all the greater. I mean, they have lifetime tenure. The Constitution gives judges this imperviousness to partisan politics that no other branch has so that they can issue judgments. But at the same time, they have to rely on the other branches for enforcement, and they always have.
Yeah, I want to ask you a follow-up question, John, because in this case, we have a Congress that is flaccid, that has rarely taken action in years. And so you have a situation where the president is forced to issue these executive orders. What does this mean when you have a judiciary without army or sword, like you mentioned, and you have a Congress that doesn't take action? What does this mean for checks and balances?
That's a great question. I think political scientists have been arguing that the effect of this kind of absent Congress for several decades now. This is the Congress we see today is not fully living up to the expectations that the founders had. They thought that Congress would be you know, like a watchdog on top of the executive branch all the time, as I said, fighting with it. It has a political incentive to fight with the president all the time. And what happened, which the founders didn't anticipate, is political parties came along. And, you know, we could blame presidents like Woodrow Wilson or Thomas Jefferson, and they wanted the political parties to cause the president and Congresses to coordinate together rather than fight with each other. And so because of that, we have a president and Congress that are controlled by the same party. And so this Congress is not going to use its constitutional powers. That means that, you know, the ultimate safeguard is elections. If people are not happy with the way Congress is doing its job, if they want there to be more oversight over the president, over these executive orders, then the best thing they can do is, you know, push the Republicans out of Congress and elect a different Congress in 2 years.
I want to play a clip now because I hear what you're saying, John, that this is not necessarily unique. But I think for a lot of people, What feels unique is the rhetoric we're hearing from folks in the administration, allied with the administration, about the judiciary. So here is a clip from President Trump's designated border czar, Tom Homan, speaking on Fox and Friends this week about the deportation case that we discussed earlier. Let's play that clip.
I wake up every morning loving my job because I work for the greatest president in the history of my life, and we're going to make this country safe again. I'm proud to be a part of this administration. We're not stopping. I don't care what the judges think. I don't care what the left thinks. We're coming. Mm-hmm.
So I don't care what the judges think. Let me ask you about that, Craig Green, because there is, I think, for legal scholars, a real question of how much do you pay attention to the rhetoric? I understand the rhetoric's not being entered into a court of law. It's not in a brief or an affidavit or whatever. But does that mean it doesn't matter here? Your thoughts?
No, I think it definitely matters. And let me just say for sure, these are unusual times. Nobody needs to say it. The reason you're having callers who are asking, what about if the president disobeys a Supreme Court order? The reason we're having a conversation about what about if you flatly disagree with a district court opinion, just fail to follow it? I think even John Ewis suggests they're doing counterproductive tactics, but they're tactics they're doing every single day. Defying judges, diminishing judges, attacking judges. This is not normal. This is not what Joe Biden did. This is not what Barack Obama did. This is not what either of the Bushes did. This is not what Richard Nixon did. This is not what Thomas Jefferson did. Nobody did these things. So this institutional attack on judges, one thing is these broad arguments about presidential power, but the other thing is this attack on judges as the decision maker traditionally under the Constitution to draw those lines, to make those decisions wherever they are. The courts are the ones supposed to make them. This is all different. This is all new. The political rhetoric is taking it to energize the base. I think that's what John had said, trying to get it outside the court of law into the court of public opinion. What does that mean? It means that if it comes to the public to try to take our responsibility to stand up for courts and law, there's already been a voice out there telling us maybe we shouldn't. There's already a voice telling me the whole system is corrupt.
But let me just real quick, though, to follow up. I think there is a argument out there, I think mostly coming from the right, that Trump is by nature a bluffer. This is what he does. He does not mean what he says. Your response to that?
Tell it to the hundreds of folks in El Salvador. Tell it to the thousands of folks who have lost their jobs. There are a lot of people who believe Trump. Tell it to all the people who were pardoned on January 6th. There are a lot of things he said he would do, and he's doing them. And he's doing them more than people would have expected, and he's making challenges to judges echoing things that he did before, but never quite like this. Bill Barr had been his attorney general. Bill Barr is now considered an exile from the Republican Party. He's way too left-wing for the second Trump administration. There is a radical shift. This is not a man who's seeking re-election himself, a person who's pursuing a different kind of legacy. I didn't see Elon Musk the first time around, and the Doge, these are transformative things that are happening in the executive branch. They're good or bad or whatever. But the thing that we're here to talk about today is whoever decides what the law limits are the courts. And this rhetoric of attacking courts is different. Bluffs sometimes you have to deliver on your bluffs. And I think this is what raises these fears about this cataclysm, about what if it ever got to the Supreme Court? What if John Roberts sort of found a certain kind of backbone and stood up against the president? And what if the president found a certain kind of backbone and stood up back the other way and refused to follow the Supreme Court order? That's a real conversation.
Yeah, that's the scary proposition that we're all worried about. I want to bring in another caller. We have Amy from Barnegat on the line. Amy, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, my comment was, it's Barnegat Light, by the way. My comment is that in this conversation, you had mentioned it earlier, the Dred Scott decision and Lincoln saying, I really can't follow this decision. But you also said, and what he also said was that if I have to, I'm going to make you make me follow it one case at a time. So he wasn't saying I simply refuse. He was saying, I'm going to make this really impossible. And he finally won at the end of the day. But the problem is, it is the law. It's been thrown in our face and been rolling over the Constitution. Time after time, the Supreme Court's made decisions that have horrified us, in some cases, some of us. And we've had to follow it, because even though the Congress made one decision, if it's been appealed and appealed and it finally ends up in the courts and the Supreme Court says this is now the law, it's the law. It's against the law to not follow the Supreme Court's ruling. And I'm very troubled that we seem to think that there's some sort of philosophical argument to be had. There's no argument here. Yeah. Bill Barr, if he was in office for a day he would last, he would say, this is illegal.
Yeah.
This is grounds for impeachment. Why are we talking as if this is an argument?
Yeah, thank you so much. That's Amy Barnegat Light on the line. I want to play, you know, because this bubbled up. And, you know, yesterday, Fox News host Laura Ingraham asked President Trump how he might respond to future court orders. And here is what he had to say, because everybody had that question. Go ahead.
But going forward,
would you defy a court order?
I never did defy a court order. And you wouldn't in the future?
No, you can't do that. However, we have bad judges. We have very bad judges. And these are judges that shouldn't be allowed. I think at a certain point, you have to start looking at what do you do when you have a rogue judge?
Now, sandwiched in there was I will follow court orders. You can't defy court orders. But John, you said that there was supposed to be this battle between the branches. You said that the founders sort of intended this. When does the battle? I mean, clearly he said he's going to comply. It's a question of whether or not he has in the current case. But sort of when does this battle sort of go off guard? We said if he defies the Supreme Court, that's it. But shouldn't it be earlier than that? Because this district court, you got appellate courts. If you defy, at a certain point, it becomes inevitable.
Well, first, I want to say that, you know, Trump is not unique in attacking judges. There were attacks by the Biden administration on judges, too. They weren't of the nature of we're going to defy judicial orders. But let's recall that President Biden formed a commission on how to restrain the power of the courts. There are many people in his party who wanted to increase the size of the Supreme Court because they didn't like the course of decisions. There are people in his party who want to impose term limits on the Supreme Court justices. There were these investigations that were done of individual justices. And ultimately, recall what happened with the student loan program where President Biden lost in the Supreme Court on his effort to forgive student loans. And then he came back and said, I'm going to do it anyway, and tried a different way to get his student loan free, which is not peanuts. It was about $400 or $500 billion of spending that he tried to get through without any bill from Congress. And I think tried to do it in defiance of a Supreme Court order. But he didn't say, I'm not going to follow.
But he did not defy an order in that case. You see no distinction here between what Biden...
I'm not saying anything he did was unconstitutional. I'm just saying that was part of this general trend of attacking judges and attacking even the Supreme Court that's been going on before Trump showed up. I'm not saying there's nothing unconstitutional about attacking judges. I mean, they're actually a convenient punching bag because they are there for life. They don't run for office. That's what puzzles me is I don't think there's anything wrong with criticizing judges. Now, Trump can go and say, I think they're rogue judges. We ought to take a look what ought to be done. But at the same time, I just heard him say, I will not defy a judicial order. I will obey all future judicial orders, regardless of what Tom Homan, I think his name is, said in that clip. He's not the lawyer. He's not an attorney general. He's not the White House counsel. Yeah. He's the border czar. Right? So I think President Trump just made clear after he spoke that he's not speaking for the administration when it comes up to living up to the obligations to carry out judicial orders.
Yeah, and Craig, I could see you right here wanting to reply. Go right ahead.
Yeah, and I think this, in a way, is one of the things that Avi was mentioning before. It's unclear how this is all going to work out because maybe he's a bluffer, maybe he doesn't deliver. There has never been this kind of systematic attack on judges and the rule of law. There never has been. The president himself said he who serves this country does not violate any laws. That's very similar to what Richard Nixon said after he was in office, where if the president does it, it's not illegal. You know, these are arguments that have been around for a long time, but they've never been made this way. They've never made from the bully pulpit. Elon Musk said maybe we should fire 1% of the judges every year. You know, that's another very high-profile vote. So what I mean to say is, like, how far will the president actually go? This conversation we're having, we're all hopeful. I think John is also hopeful that the president would follow a Supreme Court order. But these sort of storm clouds are not normal. They're not normal. This has never happened before. Attacking judges as radical left, rogue judges, corrupt judges because they ruled against them. That has never happened before. All the other things have happened. John's right about that. But never this. And I think that's why this is uniquely threatening.
Well, look, we have to leave it there. We could go on and on about this because it's such an important and fascinating topic. But let me thank you, John Yoo, professor of law at the University of California at Berkeley. He formerly served in the George W. Bush administration's Department of Justice's Office of Legal Counsel. John, thanks so much for the time.
Great to be with you.
And Craig Green, Klein professor of law and government at Temple and a former Justice Department lawyer. Greg, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Yes. And thank you to everybody who called in and gave comments. By the way, we're excited. Because
we are excited.
We are coming up on the second anniversary of Studio 2.
What?
Yes.
We made it 2 years?
We're going to be toddlers.
Not yet.
We're going to be toddlers.
I'm not gonna
jinx it. So to celebrate, we want to turn the show over to you, our loyal listeners, and we want you to pitch us your show ideas. And if your idea is selected, guess what?
What?
We'll produce a show on it during the first week of April, and we'll give you a shout out on the air.
So what do you think would make a great episode of Studio 2? Maybe it's hoagie contents.
Oh, no, man. After today, chips and pickles. I don't know.
I am shocked by people saying they don't want chips in a sandwich. Have you had chips on a sandwich?
I have. I love salt. So, yes, I would take chips, but I don't know, with pickles and bacon and long hot, you know,
the combination. The whole thing was a Frankenstein, but chips themselves, I feel like, come on.
I love chips.
Anyways.
I love Herb's chips, too.
So what do you think would make a great episode of Studio 2? Give us a call, 215-351-0525. Leave us a voicemail or email studio2@whyy.org. And hey, Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Murray-Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calicay engineered today's show. Our executive producer is the cherry relish spread man himself, Kevin McCory.
From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm hungry. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Thanks for joining us. We will talk with you tomorrow. Great show coming
bacon.
Up tomorrow.
I want some bacon, by the way.